Well, welcome everybody to concurrent session 5A. What does living longer mean for me? So, the topic today is one I think it's an emerging, it's becoming increasingly important, particularly across a lot of the areas actuaries work in around longevity, retirement strategy, and so on. And I think it's good to see a lot of you manage to back up this morning from the escapades last night. We've got two highly qualified presenters today, in Louise Campbell and Tim Furlan, who between them have about 38 years experience within the superannuation sector. Both are directors with Russell. Just to give you a bit of brief background, Louise has over 20 years experience in superannuation and has been responsible for providing actuarial consulting advice to a large number of superannuation funds over the years. She's an actuary and a relationship manager for clients including standalone funds in the public and private sector, as well as master trust clients. As for Tim, Tim's main roles are actuary and client relationship manager for several large clients and also a senior advisor within the business, and his work involves traditional legislated actuarial roles as well as broader actuarial roles like asset liability studies, risk management and superannuation accounting. So I think you'll agree we're in good hands today. I have been asked to remind you all to not forget to fill in your feedback forms, tweet or use Twitter and social media and all that sort of stuff to put your thoughts out there and hopefully we'll have an active discussion at the end and some interesting questions. So with that, without further ado, I'll hand it over.
Thanks, Wade. I'll just check this works. Oh, yep. Okay. So Tim and I wrote a paper reviewing some of the recent trends in longevity statistics. We considered how these could relate to an individual planning for their retirement, and we'll share a number of examples and findings from our paper. So we'll have a look at life expectancy, but not only averages. We'll drill down into some of the variations for individuals, and we'll follow this by a review of the main causes of death in retirement, and then we'll think about what this could mean for retirement strategies. So I'll take you through the first half of our presentation, and then I'll hand over to Tim. So what's the issue? Well, a lot of the work on longevity is focused on average life expectancies and not so much on the variations for individuals. We know when you have a look at two individuals aged 65, they could have vastly different retirement outcomes. One could live for another 40 years and the other may only have a few years left. So when you're valuing a pension benefit for a super fund or you're an insurer designing retirement products, it's fine to use those average outcomes. But with the vast majority of Australians having defined contribution super, the individuals are bearing the risk that their own experiences won't be average. When it comes to planning for their retirement, the individual will be concerned with their own personal strategy for making their money last, and an average outcome probably won't do. An individual will need a strategy first, and then a product that will fit with that strategy. So this becomes the challenge for us as actuaries. How do we stay relevant in that defined contribution world? So firstly, just having a look at the data, we know that life expectancy is important in planning for retirement. As we said, we'll have to have some idea how long the retirement nest egg will need to last. So typical statistics on life expectancy will quote averages, and if we're lucky, there might be an allowance in there for some future mortality improvements as we look ahead. But the average or the mean is not the only way of looking at life expectancy. There are other measures such as the mode and the median, and that can tell us about the shape of the distribution of longevity outcomes. So on this chart here, we're looking at female longevity based on Australian life tables from the 1880s to the most recent data in 2007. And you've got the age on the y-axis and the data points along the x-axis there. So you can see on the chart we've got the mean, that's the red line, that's the arithmetic average. And the median is the green line. So that's the point where half the population has survived to that point, to that age. And the mode is the most likely outcome for the age at death. And based on the latest data, we can see that the mean is age 84. Well, it's a little bit hard to see on this graph because they're almost all on top of each other. But the mode and the median are higher than this, and they're at around 88 to 89, or 4 or 5 years higher than the mean. So if you were thinking you might survive to the average life expectancy age, you could be underestimating the outcome by 4 or 5 years. But there are other ways of having a look at the distribution as well. So on this next graph, we've plotted the number of deaths at each age, and this is again based on Australian life tables and just female data for this one. We've only had a look at the sample periods here we've only plotted the sample periods from 1972, 91 and 2006. You can see here that when you look at the shape of the distribution, the number of the highest rate of death is for age up around 90 for females, and it's been improving over the last 25 years. So the peak of that curve is getting higher. But not only that, the shape of the distribution is changing and it's becoming more narrow. More and more women are making it through to the ages of 80 to 100. So on this next chart, we'll have a look at the data another way. And we'll think about improvements. And we're all aware that life expectancies are improving over time. And the next question is, well, how far will they go? So on this chart, we've got the number of survivors at each year, and this is plotted compared with age. So this is based on a standard population of 100,000. So that's the number of survivors in the population is shown on the y-axis and age along the x-axis. So one of the interesting features of this chart is the idea of rectangularisation of the curves drawn on the chart. So the lines head out quite horizontal for a few years, and then they drop off quite steeply and head down to 100. So we can see it's becoming more and more likely that individuals will survive to the older ages, but there does still seem to be an endpoint in the range of 100 or 110 or so, where the number of survivors tails off completely. The other interesting thing on this chart is that you can see the biggest area of improvement, I'm not sure if I can point with this, is in the ages from the late 60s to around 80. So that's the gap between that blue line and the orange line there, so where there's the biggest movement in the lines in the chart. So that also led us to consider, well, what happens with those improvements when we get up to ages around 90 to 100? How quickly have things been improving? Have a look at this next chart. We're looking at the probability of surviving from 90 to 100. So if you make it to 90, what are the chances you'll hang on to 100? So on this chart here, we've got the probability of survival on the y-axis, and then we've plotted various data points over the last 45 years or so. And the red line is females, and the blue line is the male population. So we can see with females that the probability of surviving from 90 to 100 has gone from almost 4% to over 10%. So that's a 2.5 times improvement in the last 45 years. For males, the improvement is even greater, but they started at a lower base. So they only had a 2% probability of survival back in 1960, and that's now up to around 8%. So that's a 4 times improvement over the 45 years. So another interesting feature in these charts is that the improvements are kind of linear looking, but not quite. They're still wobbling around. So we do wonder, well, how far can you take that extrapolation? How far would it have to go for half the population to make it to 100? So just having a look at the line there for females, the rate of improvement in that probability seen over the last 45 years is around 6%. So you think, well, what would happen? How long would it take for half of us to reach a median survival age of 100? Well, if you kept extrapolating at that rate, it would take around 300 years. So it's really hard to say, well, you know, how quickly are things going to improve? I think the other challenge that actuaries and statisticians face is related to population data. So just to move on to the next slide. So as you saw there, some of the data still produces wobbly lines. That line for improvements in male mortality, it wasn't really linear, and it changed sort of each time a new census came out. And in researching our paper, we noticed that the Australian life tables for 2005 to 2007, the government actuary reported that there was a technical error in the previous tables, and that meant that some of the population estimates had actually been too high at older ages. And this sort of error, it's not an isolated incident. There was a case reported in the UK, UK Actuary Online magazine, that the 2011 census results were quite different to what had been projected in the previous census, and there were actually 30,000 people fewer aged in their 90s than they'd previously thought. So it wasn't that they'd all died, they just weren't there in the first place. So we really think we'll have to keep an eye on the statistics and the census information as it comes out, and watch what happens with the trends in life expectancy. So back on one of those graphs, we saw that the improvements in life expectancy, the biggest areas were around late 60s, 70-year-olds. So that led us to consider, well, what are the causes of death at those older ages and how have they changed over time? And from that, we could also think about what does this mean for us in individually in terms of our own life expectancy and what we can do about it. So on this chart, we've got the causes of death from age 65 to 69. And this is pretty similar to a chart you would have seen if you were at this morning's session. The key with this one is it's just looking at a particular age group. So we've plotted on this chart, we've got the number of deaths, and this is an absolute number of deaths recorded in the population, the Australian population, on the y-axis, and then along the x-axis we've covered the years from 1980 through to about 2007. And we've grouped the number of deaths into a variety of areas, so circulatory, that's heart disease and stroke, neoplasm, that's forms of cancer, and then a number of other areas there, but they're much smaller on the chart. So we can see from this information that the main causes of death are circulatory, so that's heart disease and stroke, and cancers, and they're at around 70 to 80% of all the deaths. So over time, the number of deaths from heart attack and stroke has actually fallen quite significantly, but the number of deaths from cancer, it's actually increased slightly, but remained quite steady. But what that really means, this is an absolute number of deaths, but we know the population's increasing. So it means overall the death rates from cancer are actually reducing. We also know that stroke and heart attack deaths have been reducing for reasons such as controlling the risk factors like high cholesterol and better emergency care and treatment. And we know individuals can often still do more to reduce their risk factors, such as controlling their weight, lowering their cholesterol, lowering their blood pressure. The leading cause of death from cancer is lung cancer, and we know how governments have tackled that one, and that's from the prevention angle rather than the cure. So it's quit smoking campaigns, things like that. Other cancers such as breast cancer, prostate cancer and bowel cancer have also been the subject of national screening campaigns, and these are designed to identify the cancers earlier and improve the treatment and survival. So it is possible we'll see some future improvements in the rate of cancer deaths. And that also led us to consider, well, what happens in the older age groups? So we had a look at causes of death for ages 85 plus. Now on this slide, this is actually number of deaths as a proportion rather than an absolute number. So the red areas there are circulatory, so heart disease and stroke again. And that's still a major cause of death, but it's actually reducing in relative importance over time as other factors become more important. And the rates of death from cancer, that's the green one, they're relatively stable at older ages, but some other causes of death are more prevalent. So just for example, over that time period, the causes of death from mental and behavioural disorders such as Alzheimer's and dementia, that's the orange bar, they've gone from 1% of deaths to 7% of deaths. And respiratory diseases such as pneumonia, they've remained at about 8 to 10% of deaths over that period. And that also led us to consider, well, what are the prospects for improvement at those older ages? Now, we heard this morning about some areas of, research into that could affect mortality or improvements in future. But one of the things we had a look at was government grants into the national health priority areas. So we haven't really drilled down into the latest cutting-edge research, but that would be the subject of a whole other paper. We just started with research into the based on Australian government grants. So you can see on this chart here we've got the number of dollars of grants on the y-axis, and we're looking at the period from about the year 2000 to the most recent date available. So what's plotted there, the red line, for example, is the number of dollars going into research on cancer, and then the green line is research on into cardiovascular issues. So we can see that there's still a lot of money going into treating cancer and cardiovascular diseases. But it's hard to say how much that might impact on the older age groups without some more detailed study into where the money is actually going. There is money going into other areas such as mental health and dementia, but it's a lot less than the money pouring into cancer and cardiovascular research. So the mental health is the blue line on the chart there, so it's quite a long way down compared to research on cancer. Research into respiratory diseases seems to be focused on asthma, and it's more targeted at the problems in the younger end of the population rather than the aged. So based on this, it's difficult to see where we may get significant gains in mortality improvements at these older age groups right at the moment. But I guess the point of all this is we'd like to encourage people to think about living into their 90s, but unless we get some of those amazing technology improvements like were mentioned this morning, such as 3D printing of replacement organs, it doesn't look like we'll all make it to well past 100. There's still some way to go to get to that. And at that point, I'll hand over to Tim. Whoops, sorry.
That's right. Thank you, Louise. So what I'd like to do now is take some of the work that Louise has done talking about mortality and turn it into strategies that we might be able to apply to individuals. Before I do that, I'd like to take a little bit of a detour and talk about strategy. So the place where you often think about strategy besides financial planning is the military. So I've got a little story from the US Civil War. There are two people in this story, and I'm not going to talk about the winner, General Lee from the Confederate side. I actually want to talk about the other guy, General George B. McClellan from the Union. So General McClellan, he was a conservative sort of a chap, very cautious, very well prepared, not unlike a few actuaries that I know. Trained his troops really well, always made sure they were ready to go into battle. Now, he led a campaign from the Union side called the Peninsula Campaign. They landed in Virginia and pushed along this peninsula towards Richmond, which was the Confederate capital. And he initially had some really good success, got pretty much right up to the outskirts of Richmond. But he stopped there. Being cautious, he was a little bit worried, maybe I'm outnumbered, I'm not sure what I'm going to find in Richmond. So he didn't push on. In practice, well, what actually happened was he outnumbered the other side 2-1. And he could have pushed on. He could have pushed through Richmond. Maybe he would have ended the war there and then 2 years early. But instead he stopped. Meanwhile, the Confederates, they reinforced their side. They counterattacked. He fought off the first counterattack, but they kept coming. And he, being cautious, being conservative, still not sure if he was outnumbered, started to withdraw. Meanwhile, the Confederates could see where he was going and were able to push him back almost all the way out of Virginia. So the message around strategy that I take from that story is that you don't want to be reckless with your strategies. That being cautious and conservative, going to the other extreme, isn't the right answer either. And that's very much the case when we start to talk about longevity. So the first thing, turning back to longevity, that I want to take you through in developing a strategy to deal with longevity is the level of contributions that individuals need to make to their superannuation. So before you even get to retirement and start thinking about how you're going to draw down your super, you need to be putting the right amount of superannuation in. This chart shows a little bit of an illustration, 2% real return, 40-year working career. What are the contribution rates along the y-axis there that a person would need to make for different assumptions about how long they're going to live? So if they assume that they're only going to live to 80, maybe they could get away with putting an 8% contribution in. At the other extreme, if they assume they're going to live to 110, they need to be putting in something like 18%. So you see the range there. It's almost, well, it's more than double from one end of the chart through to the other end of the chart. So people need a little bit of guidance. The distribution of outcomes that Louise was talking about, it's actually really important we get a good understanding of that so that we're not leaving people with this huge range and no guidance about where on the range they should be. The other element, coming back to my story, is we don't want to be overly conservative. It's easy to see, and we all know what happens for people that don't contribute enough, you run out of money. What about people that go the other way and assume they're going to live to 110 or beyond and put too much in? Well, you're taking money out of the pockets of people that need it. Yeah. They don't have that money to pay off a mortgage. It's money that could have gone to school fees, it could have gone to travel, something else to enjoy their lives while they're young and able to do that. So being overly cautious, overly conservative when you look at this isn't good enough either. What we need to do is give people some better guidance rather than just being conservative with our measures. The second element that I'd turn to when we talk about strategy then is, having got through to retirement, how much am I going to draw down? And you get a similar sort of dynamic. What we've done here is have a lump sum for someone that, if they draw it down and investment returns are as expected, they'll be able to draw down $50,000 a year until they get to 80, and then no more money from there. If they take that same lump sum and decide to spread over a longer period of time, those numbers across the x-axis, then obviously they're going to be able to draw down less. So from 50,000, if they assume they're going to live to 80, if they assume they're going to live to 110, 120, they can probably only draw down something like $20,000. So again, there's a doubling or a halving as you go from one end of the chart to the other. Being overly conservative means that people get half as much income than they might have otherwise had to live on. That's a pretty important dynamic. When you think about your retirement, when you're young, that's probably when you've got the chance to take that little bit of extra money, go and travel, enjoy yourself. If we are too conservative, we're going to be telling people, no, don't do that. Put it away for an end of life that you may never actually get to. Again, it's just not good enough to give people that sort of advice. That we need to get a little bit better in understanding the true dynamics of mortality so we can give people some good advice without panicking. Now, the third element of strategy that I won't talk about in a lot of detail today is investments. Investing over the accumulation phase and the retirement phase we think is really important. Some of my colleagues at Russell came up with what we call the 10-30-60 rule around investments through retirement. It says that for every dollar you spend in retirement, 10 cents came from your own contributions, 30 cents came from investment income prior to retirement, and 60 cents came from investment income that you earned after you retired. The dynamic there is, you know, you've got your largest balance probably about the time that you retire, so those first few years of retirement's when you actually earn a lot of money, assuming investment markets go well. So we think investment's really important. Another topic, so we don't touch on a lot of detail this paper, but I didn't want to go past it as we move through this. So the fourth element then, having dealt with how long we expect to live investments, is dealing with the risk around investments. Risk around longevity, sorry. This next little slide has a look at how that risk changes over someone's life. So Louise showed you some charts that gave you a sense that that risk is becoming less, that the range of outcomes for people are narrowing. We'd suggest that the risk actually changes as you move through your life as well. What we have here on the y-axis is a coefficient of variation of longevity, and along the x-axis is a series of ages from 0 through to 100. And what you see is your distribution of outcomes when you're quite young is lower, and it gets higher and higher as you get through to about 90. Thinking about this in plain sort of English terms, when you're 60, if you're in pretty good health, you can count on living well into your 80s, if not your 90s. The range of outcomes is at the end of your life in the 80s or 90s, assuming nothing unfortunate happens to you. When you're 90, even if you are in reasonably good health for a 90-year-old, you know, you might make it another year or you might make it 10 years. The range of outcomes relative to where you are is quite high. Now, this is important when you come to think about getting risk protection. Clearly, the more risk, the more need there is for risk protection. So we've had a look on the next slide at one of the ways to look at the value of risk protection and when it becomes important to actually purchase some risk protection. So what we've done here is, along the y-axis, calculated an internal rate of return on an annuity. If you think about a lifetime annuity, you pay a lump sum, $100,000, $200,000, $500,000, and you get a fixed series of payments for the rest of your life. So if you make an assumption about how long you'll live, you can calculate an internal rate of return on that annuity and work out, is it a good deal or not? So we can do a little bit of sensitivity analysis, given we don't know how long we're going to live, have a look at, well, what happens if I live to the average life expectancy? What happens if I live longer than three quarters of people my age, or extreme, longer than 95% of people my age, so 19 out of 20 other people? And that's exactly what we've plotted. We haven't plotted the median, because at the median, probably annuity doesn't make a lot of sense, but plotted the upper quartile and the 95th percentile for different purchase ages. So for our 60-year-old, right at the far left-hand side of that chart, the 75th percentile for 60-year-olds, so three-quarters of 60-year-olds won't make it to 89. 25% or one-quarter will make it beyond 89. The 95th percentile, 97. So we'd expect 19 out of 20 60-year-olds not to make it to 97 and 1 in 20 to make it beyond 97. And so with those expected ages or sensitivities around the ages and how many payments I'm going to get out of this annuity, I can calculate internal rate of return. At 60, for my 75th percentile, it's about 1.25%. For my 95th percentile, it's about 2.5%. So not a fantastic rate of return. Now, this takes into account the fact that annuities tend to be backed by fixed interest, insurers need to make a profit, they've got capital requirements and the like. That's why it's not that much of an exciting return. What gets interesting, though, is have a look at 90. You can see the chart slopes upward. At 90, the 75th percentile for 90-year-olds survival is 97. So a quarter of 90-year-olds would expect to make it beyond 97. 95th percentile, 102. Now, consistent with those figures that Louise showed earlier about survival from 90 to 100, you know, it's probably single digits will make it from 90 to 100, or we said about 5% will make it to 102. The return in that case, 6% at 97, for a 90-year-old at the 75th percentile, and 14.5% if you make it to the 95th percentile. So the returns are looking a lot more attractive. But I'm not actually looking at this as an investment. I'm not saying, look, those returns are really attractive, let's go buy some annuities. What it is a test around self-insurance. If I'm going to self-insure my longevity as a 90-year-old and I want 95% certainty it's going to see me through, I need an investment that's going to return 14.5% real. Now, if anyone knows an investment that returns 14.5% real on a pretty low risk basis, I'll be waiting outside afterwards. Come and see me, please. It's difficult, right? You're not going to get that sort of return. So there is probably value in going out and getting that sort of risk protection. On the other hand, at 60, there's maybe a little less value in that risk protection. Your ability to self-insure is stronger. In reality, there will be a point that will depend on investment markets, interest rates, annuity pricing, when this ticks over and it makes sense to move from self-insurance to insurance at some point over your retirement. So I said buying an annuity later might be a good idea. Now, we know what's topical at the moment, deferred annuities. So we did the same analysis again for deferred annuities, and it doesn't exactly produce what you'd expect. It doesn't say, look, deferred annuities are actually a great investment that fits in with what we've just shown. You get a lot of the same dynamic, but in fact your exposure to longevity is somewhat leveraged. The chart works in the same sort of way. We've got ages across the x-axis. They only go up to 85 because we're talking about annuity deferred until 85, and we've got internal rates of return along the y, up the y-axis. At 60, the 75th percentile is about 1%, a touch lower than what we saw before, and at the 95th percentile it's about 4%. So that's a function of the illustration that we've put together here. I've made assumptions around how annuities are priced. It's never going to be actuarially fair, annuity prices in the market, so you're never going to find that it's exactly a good deal if you're going to live to only the 50th percentile. You've got to live longer than average to get value out of an annuity, and that's what we're seeing here. I've probably put enough selection, profit margin for insurers and the like in there that it's not fantastic, it's kind of neutral at the 75th percentile, but by the time you get to the 95th percentile, it's a little bit better. So annuities, or deferred annuities, don't solve the problem either. You come back to the sort of strategy I said around an element of self-insurance, an element of insurance, and guiding people around when's the right time to shift from self-insurance to insurance. So very much strategy is important and comes before product, as Louise was saying. So there's a couple of things that I'd like to leave you with from the presentation, and there's more detail in the paper if you get the chance to read it. The first would be that individuals are not average. Talking about individuals, talking to individuals, developing strategies using the average just isn't good enough. Doesn't help people through the risk that they're facing. The other thing about not being average, that chart that Louise showed around the causes of death for a 65 to 69 year olds, very stark, those two main causes of death. So do something about cardiac, about screening for cancer, about not smoking. Make sure you get it through 65 to 69. I know personally I'd like to be better than average and have a longevity problem. Second thing, we think individuals need strategies to deal with the risks that they're facing. So first and foremost, before we come up with a fancy product solution that we think is going to help individuals, it needs to fit into a strategy that the individuals can work through to get them through their retirement. When we've got a strategy, when you understand the different bits and pieces that you need, you know, starting with what to contribute, an annuity isn't going to help you with how much to contribute before you retire, then we can start to talk about where different products fit into that strategy. And finally, overstating the risks really isn't helpful. Encouraging people to be too cautious, too conservative, like my little story, it's not going to lead them to success. We need to be realistic about the risks that people are facing, help them with those risks, rather than being overly conservative, encouraging them to save too much, pushing their consumption to their end of their life, where they can't enjoy it, or where maybe they don't even actually get the opportunity to spend the money and have that. Now, realistically, the contribution, the drawdown, it's about spreading consumption evenly over people's lifetimes. And we're successful if that's what we achieve for individuals. Thank you for coming along today. I think that's all we've got from the formal presentation. I think we have got a little bit of time now to take questions. So happy to take questions and comments. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Tim and Louise. I guess, happy to throw it to the floor. I think there are some roving microphones. If you can hopefully walk up or make your way to a microphone, state your name and where you're from, and we'll take it from there.
Thanks.
thanks.
Thank you very much for your presentation. My name is Katja Hanewald. I'm a researcher at the at UNSW. We have a Center of Excellence Population Aging. We have a lot of colleagues working on these topics, heterogeneity and mortality, investment strategies. So I'm very happy to see that you are actually also interested in these topics. I'd like to know a bit more detail, if possible, how you address these problems and how you add value to an individual's planning problem. Do you actually model individuals' heterogeneous health outcomes? Do you take that into account, or do you factor in how life expectancy can be different for your clients? And do you then embed the different models, the different products that you recommend, maybe in a life cycle model, and actually try to model the outcomes over a longer perspective? So I would be happy to hear more details. Thank you.
Yep. Russell's an investment firm, so our focus very much has been on life cycle models and our research around the investing element of it. Haven't been directly involved in advising individuals, but certainly what we'd be suggesting is that it is important to think about individuals' health outcomes. When I talk about the topic, one of the things I do encourage people to do is think about living to 90. If you're healthy, if you pay attention to some of those comments on risk factors around cardiac causes of death, around cancer, and you can avoid those things, your chances of getting through that 65 to 69 period are pretty good. And the same continues. It's a little bit harder to get from 90 to 100, as Louise showed, but certainly people should be thinking about living to 90, doing the right sort of thing for their health to get through to 90. So we're certainly not suggesting people underestimate mortality, but encouraging people to think about their health, I think, is a great thing. And then trying to feed that into planning will be constructive. Do you want to add anything?
I think my take on the period where people pass the sort of active stage of retirement and they start to have, you know, more than one causes of morbidity, you know, illness, there's actually not a lot of research into that, you know, how what will happen when people have multiple causes of illness and how long will they last in that stage. So there are studies out there, you know, but they're often isolated on what does this one cause do to life expectancy. Or I think in conclusion it would just be the best person to talk to would be a GP, because they're used to dealing with real people and having real situations, and they're not doing studies of, you know, the impact of a drug on one particular illness. So I think there's a lot more work that could be done on looking at how healthy are people going to be in retirement and the stages of retirement.
Thanks. Peter Brown from Vero in New Zealand. It's an interesting subject, people getting to 90, and as I'm just about, very shortly, my mother's just about to turn that age, and it's interesting, one of the things that you noticed, and we've noticed with mum, is that as she gets older, she spends less, she does less, and so on. Everything I seem to see on a lot of this subject says, you know, you target an amount of money, and you just assume you're going to need that much every year for the rest of your life. That doesn't seem to be the reality we've seen, and particularly in these days of low inflation, it's not like you've got to worry too much about that. So that was one question, interested in what people's thoughts are on that. And it's interesting, an actuary I know who's just retired at age 70 said, I'm looking forward to 10 years of very active life and then 10 years of just sort of sitting around and not doing very much. And that was his financial plan. He'd based this on his family members. It seemed to be about 90 when they all seemed to drop off. So there's some interesting perspectives on that. You know, interested in any comments on that?
Look, definitely the stages of retirement is important. We tried to have a little bit of a look at that in the paper. Unfortunately, data about spending through retirement, we're only sort of starting to get some of that through now. Data about health and morbidity through retirement was another area we tried to find a little bit more about but didn't have a lot of success, because it is sort of the anecdotal experience, completely agree, that you have a healthy period of retirement, then maybe a less active, and then, you know, there's some time in a nursing home potentially. That's part of why, you know, I'm very strong on not being overly conservative with estimates around here, because telling people to not spend it while they're young, while they can enjoy it, isn't advice that's going to serve those individuals well. The other comment I'd make around the lack of data is that some of the studies that do exist come out of other experience, like the US experience, where there's a different system. You know, the Australian system, we've got the government subsidising aged care, so it does create a different financial dynamic around the end of life. And we really do need to get some Australian data to get a good sense of the spending over people's lifetime, which I understand is in progress, but not quite there yet.
John Slack, ANZ. I found that graph that you showed of the funding needs, if whether you're going to reach 80, 90, 100, 110, 120. Sorry, I'll stand up. I think it's lacking a little bit in context. I'm thinking from a, a financial planning point of view. You know, like how many 120-year-olds will there be, for example? If it overlaid the probability of reaching that age with that funding model, I think that would be a very powerful tool. So you'd know that 75% will reach, whatever, 90 or 85, and 1% will reach 110 or something.
Yeah, that's exactly the purpose of showing that chart, that that chart by itself is incredibly unhelpful. You know, we could be telling people spend $20,000 a year or spend $50,000 a year, that you actually need to narrow it down, and probabilities are one way to do it, narrow it down to a part of that chart that is most relevant. And if we can incorporate health and narrow it down to a part of the chart that's most relevant for the individual, I think it's even more useful. If you look at 90 to 100, there's still some variation there, or maybe 90 to 95, but it's certainly a lot narrower than looking at that whole spectrum of that chart.
I was looking at your deferred annuity slide. I think the way that you've looked at that as an investment, assuming if you take the 60-year-old, assuming you're a lump sum purchase at that point of time, looked at as an investment, I actually think that's the wrong way to look at deferred annuities. So I actually think deferred annuities should be looked at as an insurance product. And so that basically, and if you turn it into an annual premium deferred annuity, if there's such a thing, then what you've got is you've actually got an annual insurance premium that you're paying to protect yourself about living longer. And I think if you actually turn it into an insurance product, the fact is that with an insurance product, if you pay a premium on insuring your house, you're not overly concerned about the fact that your house doesn't burn down and you don't get your insurance premium. You're actually prepared to allow the insurance premium to be dissipated and not get any value back for it at all. So if you actually did that calculation and worked out what the cost of insurance was every year on a sort of annual premium basis, I think you then start to see the deferred annuity may in fact have a relevance in a strategic sense. Because once you know that you can not worry about living past, say, 85 or something, 85, then you can actually spend your capital between 60 and 85 and know that you're covered if you live longer.
Thanks for the comment, Glenn. We did look at it as an insurance problem. You might recall that I said it was about giving people a hurdle rate to assess self-insurance versus insurance, because that choice is there. You can self-insure your longevity or you can purchase the insurance, and the economic way to look at it, one economic way to look at it is to compare the internal rate of return of the two investments that are there. Yes, there are certainly other ways to look at self-insurance. Peace of mind is something that you might place emphasis on. But we are absolutely looking at it as an insurance problem. The other thing to remember with deferred annuities and with annuities is that they're a bundled product. So they are bundling a component of investment. In the case of our deferred annuity from 60 to 85, I'm bundling 25 years of investment of that premium along with the actual pure insurance. One of the potential ways that this could go as the market develops could be further unbundling. You know, we've probably thought of deferred annuities as perhaps a little less bundled than an immediate life annuity, and they are, but they're still not fully unbundled. So it's still confusing investment and insurance issues.
Sorry, Anthony Ashot. Just, Tim, you mentioned the question of data emerging. Just what is it that's... I mean, I'm just interested in what data is coming out. I mean, we know at the Retirement Incomes Working Group, we've got some access to HILDA and some access to FACSIA data. Looking at getting access from insurance companies, but it seems to me that what we really want is something that is holistic. It looks at all financial assets and something that also looks at health and welfare outcomes. So with the interaction with dementia, the interaction with satisfaction with life and all this type of stuff. Do you know of anything that's sort of going on in that area?
I don't think I know anything that you don't know about. I was referring to the HILDA data, which will take a number of years before that sort of plays itself out and you've got that good longitudinal data.
I think we've got five more minutes. If anyone's got any other questions, scanning the... There we go. Always get a volunteer.
Well done.
Thanks. Michael Berg. Perhaps joining the challenge of the General McClellan-style conservative strategy, did you look at situations where people who perhaps sort of middle to lower middle income potentially making sense to just deliberately use up all their money and then use the a combination of the state pension and equity release on the home to keep going from there, and that potentially being better than trying to spread the money uniformly over the retirement period?
Not for this paper. We've done some other work around the age pension and sort of the value in that as a risk management strategy. This paper largely focused on longevity, causes of death. Can we narrow down the range of outcomes that people are facing to give them some advice around where to look at with those spending charts?
Okay, well, if that's it, I think it's been a very sort of insightful session in what's obviously a hot topic and will continue to be so, as evidenced by the discussion. Please thank Tim and Louise for their contribution, and we've got...